The terrifying premise of Five Nights at Freddy's wasn't fantasy. It was a sanitized retelling of a real 1980s shutdown where the mechanized performers were not props, but restricted industrial machines tied directly to disappearances. Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is where we take your source material and just plunge headfirst into the details that really matter. Our goal is to leave you with all the knowledge and none of the, you know, the informational baggage. And today you've handed us a pretty substantial stack of sources. Mm-hmm. They detail this incredibly strange, very localized incident from the late 1980s, all centered around a family entertainment venue in Utah.
And it reads less like folklore, doesn't it? It's more like a blueprint for a modern industrial tragedy.
Exactly. A highly contained, officially buried nightmare involving some seriously powerful machinery and just chilling protocols of secrecy.
So our mission for this deep dive is, I think, very specific. We have to follow a precise, documented causal chain that's laid out in these sources.
Yeah.
We have to trace the narrative meticulously. We're going to move from the industrial origins of these supposed family entertainers.
Just called the entertainers, yeah.
All the way through to the period of disappearances, then the escalating sequence of mechanical anomalies that the night staff started noticing.
Which is where it gets really strange.
And then, of course, the fatal incident. And finally, the systematic, almost institutional decision to just erase every single trace of what truly happened.
It's a case study, really.
It is. It's fundamentally a case study in what you'd call mechanical risk convergence. How fast a tech trend can become a genuine lethal hazard, and just how efficiently those hazards can be covered up when, you know, regulatory oversight is weak and liability is sky high.
Okay, so let's unpack this.
Okay.
I think we need to start by setting the scene, establishing the context.
Absolutely.
We're in the mid to late 1980s, and across the entire United States, there's this massive decentralized boom in family entertainment centers.
Yeah, they were everywhere.
If you were a child back then, you know these places. Dimly lit, smelling saintly of like old carpet and pizza grease.
Mm-hmm.
And dominated by these brightly painted mechanical mascots performing on these simple little stages. It was a cultural phenomenon, mm-hmm. a commercial trend.
And that widespread trend provides the perfectly innocent backdrop for the specific and frankly terrible events that unfolded in Utah. And that commercial trend is essential to understand because it drove demand so far beyond what legitimate, you know, safety-focused manufacturers could supply cheaply.
Hey, so everyone wanted one.
Everyone wanted their own stage show, every small-scale franchise owner. And the economics of custom-building complex, safe animatronics were just prohibitive.
So they cut corners.
That's where it gets interesting. And what your sources really hammer home is the true technical lineage of these early machines. We tend to see them today as, like, oversized toys.
Right.
But they were directly inspired by, and sometimes, you know, literally derived from heavy, complex industrial robotics.
That one technical detail.
Yeah.
That is the single most important pivot in this entire story.
It changes everything.
You're not talking about light stage props. We're talking about powerful, jointed mechanisms, probably driven by high-pressure hydraulics or high-torque pneumatics.
Technologies that had their roots not in entertainment, but on the factory floor.
For what kind of tasks?
Welding, precision cutting, or moving multi-ton engine blocks, that kind of thing.
And the difference in purpose. That fundamentally alters the risk profile, doesn't it?
Completely. A custom-built entertainment unit is designed at its core to be near people.
Okay.
So it has built-in visible safety interlocks, you know, soft stops, a limited reach. But a factory robot, especially one from the early 80s, it's designed for brute force, for repeatability.
And the safety for those things relies on what?
Two things. Massive physical caging to keep humans out, and highly specialized, trained personnel operating under rigid safety protocols.
And when you take that kind of second-generation industrial tech and you drop it directly into a chaotic, loud, low-supervision environment, like a family restaurant,
you create an unprecedented liability.
The key danger, which these sources lay out with really striking clarity, is that these machines were, and this is a quote, never designed to be around children unsupervised.
And that one regulatory failure, that's the ticking clock for the entire tragedy. Just think about the sheer kinetic energy involved. I mean, if a heavy-duty hydraulic arm, one that's built to lift, say, 70 pounds of metal, if that malfunctions or gets an unexpected command, that force doesn't just disappear.
It has to go somewhere.
Exactly. A modern parallel would be it's like installing a high-capacity forklift in a daycare center and then just taking away the safety cage.
That's a terrifying image.
The safety tolerances required for a factory where workers have lockdown procedures and high visibility zones, they are completely absent in a place where children are just running around, climbing, exploring.
The fundamental geometry of the risk was just totally misaligned with the environment from the second they were installed.
Totally.
So the technical risk profile was already enormous, and then it was compounded by the economic motivation of the business owners.
Mm-hmm.
It was cheaper to adapt an existing powerful machine than to commission a new, safe one.
Absolutely. And the cost savings often meant they were acquiring older units, units that were already being phased out in serious industrial environments.
Why? Why were they being phased out?
Precisely because they were less efficient, or maybe they lacked newer electronic safety features. These older systems, they often relied on like hard stop programming and high pressure fluid lines, which makes any malfunction exponentially more dangerous.
Okay, so let's narrow the focus now. We're moving from that broad national context of inherent risk to the specific location that concerns us.
The family restaurant in Utah, late 1980s.
This is where the story shifts from, you know, theoretical danger to acute localized tragedy.
And the specifics of this venue are critical, particularly when it comes to the animatronic performers themselves.
What did the former employees say?
In the interviews in your sources, they consistently refuse to describe them as standard entertainment models. They use that deeply, deeply chilling phrase, outdated factory units repurposed for entertainment.
That phrase alone, outdated factory units, it's just loaded with implications.
It is.
If they were already deemed outdated, that immediately suggests they were acquired cheaply, maybe at an auction or a distress sale, as industrial scrap, basically.
Right. Which means they likely lacked modern safety interlocks. They were probably relying on specialized, soon-to-be-obsolete mechanical parts. And they definitely weren't designed with, you know, soft aesthetic shells.
They would have been metal.
Heavy.
Functionally terrifying if you saw them without their colorful outer casing.
We're talking about mechanisms originally designed for sheer industrial utility. Welding, moving engine blocks, repeated high-force tasks. Not for aesthetics.
And an outdated unit. That often means its maintenance requirements are high and proprietary, right?
Very high. It's hard to find generic parts, which forces the maintenance expertise into a very tight, very controlled circle.
And that proprietary maintenance issue.
Yeah.
That brings us to the second critical layer of vulnerability here, the human element of secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
The sources describe these strict protocols. Maintenance was severely, almost religiously restricted.
This is crucial.
The sources state, only the owner was allowed to access the internal mechanisms.
And that is the operational black box. It's the single point of failure in control that facilitates the entire cover-up that happens later. It creates intentional, absolute opacity around the function, the condition, and the actual programming of these machines.
And the staff.
The staff were explicitly warned not to ask questions. This established a pervasive culture of silence, of fear, really. It discouraged anyone from reporting anomalies or questioning the maintenance routines.
So if a machine malfunctions in a normal restaurant, the manager calls an external repair service.
Mm-hmm.
That creates a paper trail.
Exactly.
But here, the process is sealed. Every anomaly, every necessary repair, every sudden operational change, it all becomes an unchallengeable secret managed by one single person.
And that one person holds all the keys to the mechanical liability. They're managing potential regulatory breaches because of the repurposed nature of the units.
So if the owner was the one doing the maintenance, they could be doing anything. Necessary repairs, maybe, but also unauthorized modifications.
Or, crucially, removing or concealing evidence related to mechanical damage or something else. This perfectly exemplifies that concept in failure analysis that control hides best in plain sight.
The owner wasn't just managing the mechanical function.
They were managing the evidence.
Wait, okay, let me challenge that for a second. If the owner was the sole maintenance provider, couldn't that just be a cost-saving measure?
It's possible.
The parts were obsolete, the tech was specialized. Isn't it possible they were just trying to save money by doing the highly technical work themselves?
It is possible, yes, but we have to look at the consequence of that choice, regardless of the motive. By centralizing all knowledge and all access, they introduced a layer of vulnerability that went way beyond simple economics.
Okay.
If they were cutting costs, they were simultaneously cutting safety accountability. And if we connect this forward to the disappearances, that operational black box ensures that if something illegal or negligent or catastrophic happened with that machinery, there would be no internal witness.
No repair tech, No assistant manager.
Nobody who could expose the truth of the machine's involvement. So the motive, it shifts from simple cost saving to systemic concealment.
And that brings us to the core horrifying tragedy that this controlled, opaque environment enabled. The disappearances.
Mm-hmm.
Your sources detail a chilling pattern of children going missing in the area over time.
And that emphasis on over time is crucial. This wasn't a sudden mass casualty event that would draw immediate, you know, FBI attention.
It was slower, more insidious.
It implies either a persistent local threat operating with impunity or, more disturbingly, a series of individual incidents that were spaced out just enough to keep them administratively distinct in the eyes of local police.
Preventing the critical mass of suspicion.
Exactly. It prevented that high-level intervention that was so desperately needed.
And the connection to the restaurant is just chillingly specific.
Yeah.
The sources indicate that several of these children were last seen attending birthday parties right there at the venue.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't just a neighborhood threat. This location is the last known point of contact.
It forces us to ask the question, how does a public, family-oriented space, a place filled with noise and other families and staff, become the site of disappearances?
The chaos could be camouflage.
It's excellent camouflage. Between the loud music from the animatronics, the chatter of parties, the general chaos of kids running around, a quick, localized incident, or an abduction, or even a catastrophic mechanical failure could be easily masked.
So the proximity is undeniable.
Undeniable. Yet the operational mechanisms of the restaurant, especially those secrecy protocols, ensured that the connection remained unprovable.
And that lack of direct evidence is the administrative detail that allowed the whole situation to fester. The sources explicitly state there was no direct evidence linking the restaurant or the animatronic units to the missing children.
This is the pivot point where the official records really solidify the tragedy. Because there was no immediate physical proof, no signs of a struggle, no obvious bodily traces found right away, the cases were treated as separate, unrelated, random disappearances.
A procedural decision.
Likely a procedural decision based on the available evidence, yes. But that decision allowed the restaurant to continue operating despite this terrifying circumstantial proximity to the incidents.
So the effectiveness of the owner's secrecy protocols, ensuring that the industrial nature of the machine stayed hidden and inaccessible, that effectively concealed any immediate physical link.
It did. The legal and investigative records, they were left paralyzed because they couldn't penetrate that mechanical black box.
The investigation just stalled.
Exactly. The local police are dealing with what looks like multiple separate missing persons files, while the restaurant, the one potential common link, just continues to function as normal.
It's a disturbing reality.
It highlights how official records can sometimes just freeze while lives keep moving and the threats just continue to operate. It took the increasing internal anomalies, the things the night staff were seeing, to finally force the system to acknowledge the localized danger.
And that leads us directly to the escalation. We're moving from the external disappearances to the physical internal evidence that was being noticed by the few employees who had to be inside that building after hours.
This is the tipping point.
This is where that controlled environment starts to fail and the true mechanical secrets start to leak out.
And these night staff, they were already operating in silence under that don't ask questions mandate. So they were essentially acting as involuntary, terrified witnesses to the machine's unauthorized operations.
And their documentation, the odd and unsettling patterns they recorded.
Physical, measurable changes in the building's operational status. Those are the first genuine pieces of proof that the owner's control was either failing or being leveraged for something highly secretive.
Okay. Let's break down the three specific physical anomalies they documented. Because if you take them together, they paint this picture of powerful, sustained, unauthorized activity happening in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
The first, and maybe the most mechanically indicative, was power consumption. They noted that power consumption increased after closing.
Which is significant. It completely contradicts normal standby operations.
What should it have been doing?
If the units were truly just idling, waiting for the morning show, their power draw should be minimal. Maybe enough for a clock or a low-level controller board. A significant spike in power consumption implies actuators are firing, heavy motors are rotating, or high-pressure hydraulic pumps are cycling intensely.
And if we remember these were outdated factory units, we have to consider the kind of power they would demand.
Right.
These weren't running on standard household current. They'd likely be drawing on three-phase industrial power. Any sudden spike wouldn't just be a blip on the electric bill. It would represent the deployment of immense potential kinetic energy.
The kind of energy required to move hundreds of pounds of metal.
Exactly.
We're talking about the difference between a high-power oven turning on and a piece of heavy stamping equipment running. If the power consumption spikes, it confirms that some component requiring significant torque or pressure was operational. In short, something heavy was running.
Running a full sequence of programmed movements, maybe.
Or, more ominously, being actively controlled by someone inside.
And that intense, unexpected power draw that leads logically to the second anomaly, security failures.
Yeah.
Employees documented that security cameras failed intermittently. Now, we have to analyze this carefully. Is this just systemic failure of old 1980s analog CCTV, or is there a direct link here?
Given the power spike, a potential technical explanation is a localized brownout.
A brownout.
When a massive industrial load is suddenly thrown onto the system, it can cause a temporary severe drop in voltage across the whole circuit. And 1980s analog surveillance equipment was highly sensitive to voltage fluctuations.
The animatronics power up, the voltage drops.
And the sensitive cameras could easily fail or shut down momentarily, creating a critical blind spot exactly when the machines were most active.
That technical link is powerful, so the active concealment wasn't necessarily a person throwing a switch on the cameras.
It could have been the sheer force of the machine's unauthorized operation interfering with the surveillance equipment itself.
But we also have to consider the human element, the owner.
We must. Given the owner's monopoly on access, if the intermittent failures were specific to the moment an animatronic engaged in some unauthorized movement, well, one could easily speculate that these failures were engineered.
The owner cutting power to the cameras during their secretive night work.
Either that, or the very act of unauthorized maintenance or modification was causing electromagnetic interference or even physical damage to the security system's wiring. Either way, the result is the same. The employees observed active, recurring periods of enforced darkness.
And the third anomaly. This provides the irrefutable physical proofs that something was acting on these massive units. Animatronics were found in positions they hadn't been left in.
This is the culmination of the evidence, the movement itself.
For industrial-grade animatronics, this is the ultimate red flag, isn't it?
It absolutely is. These machines are designed for rigidity in their idle state. They don't just drift. To change the position of a heavy, articulated industrial arm requires massive power and the execution of complex control commands.
So this is not a slight shift?
No. This represents a deliberate, forceful repositioning.
This moves the whole phenomenon from a potential electrical glitch or faulty wiring into the realm of conscious complex operation.
It does. It suggests either that someone was actively accessing the controls after hours, maybe violating the owner's own protocols, or perhaps it was the owner himself, or that the machines were running complex programs entirely unknown to the night staff, programs tied to whatever operational duties the owner was conducting in secret.
And that leads to a horrifying thought for those employees.
Mm-hmm.
They're not just finding a prop has moved. They're finding that hundreds of pounds of heavy, high-force machinery has executed a maneuver in the dark.
It transforms the environment. It's no longer an empty restaurant. It's a potentially active, lethal workspace in the pitch dark.
The accumulating pressure from these anomalies, the power spikes, the surveillance gaps, the physical repositioning of the machines, it finally culminated in the single fatal incident.
The death of one night guard during his shift.
And this guard's death is the final compelling piece of evidence that the environment had become actively lethal.
Yet the physical findings were deeply contradictory and suspicious given the context.
The paradox is that despite dying in an environment demonstrably compromised by powerful, moving, unauthorized machinery, there were no visible injuries.
No crushing, no impact trauma, no obvious signs of violence.
And that lack of physical evidence facilitated the official finding. The cause of death was listed as heart failure.
So we're left with this massive question mark. Was this a genuine health event, or was that official listing a convenient classification for a death that was actually induced by environmental shock?
You mean the shock of seeing one of these things move?
Think about it. If the guard was suddenly confronted by an actively running, powerful metal industrial machine in the dark performing unauthorized movements, the shock alone could easily be fatal, particularly if the person had any underlying undiagnosed cardiac vulnerability.
The sudden hydraulic hiss, the grinding of gears, the sight of this massive figure moving towards them.
It would be an extreme shockwave to the system. But we also have to consider the environment itself.
What do you mean?
Given these were repurposed industrial units, was it possible the guard was exposed to something else? High voltage arcs? Extreme noise levels that were dangerous? Maybe a sudden pneumatic discharge that, you know, while not leaving visible trauma, could cause fatal physiological stress.
And the heart failure classification.
It conveniently bypasses the meter for authorities to investigate the external environmental threat. It assigns the death to an internal condition, effectively insulating the industrial mechanisms from any scrutiny.
And that death, suspicious or not, was the event that finally forced the closure of the operation. The restaurant was shut down. But officially, the reason given was safety violations.
That phrase is regulatory gold. It's the perfect legally sanctioned pretext.
How so?
It allows the authorities to close a site they know is dangerous, possibly tied to disappearances and a sudden death, without ever having to publicly admit to the true nature of the problem.
Which was?
Repurposed industrial robotics, mechanical anomalies, and potential criminal negligence.
So we have to analyze the motivation for using this specific pretext.
Mm.
Did the safety violations actually reflect the known anomalies, like the bad wiring or something? Or were they just a convenient legal mechanism to close a site that was dangerous for profound non-procedural reasons?
It's the path of least resistance. Investigating a safety violation is straightforward. You cite the faulty fire extinguisher, the broken railing, the non-compliant wiring.
Easy.
Investigating a rogue industrial robot that may be linked to multiple missing children and a suspicious death, that requires massive resources, political capital, and critically, public accountability.
So using the safety violation is a quick fix.
It's a quick fix that achieves the desired outcome closure while minimizing institutional liability and public spectacle.
Okay, so following the shutdown, the authorities finally gained full access. Inspectors moved in to examine the animatronic units.
Mm-hmm.
This was the moment. The moment the official record had the potential to establish the truth about these units, to prove they were repurposed or dangerous or compromised.
And this is where we hit the wall of institutional erasure.
The sources confirm that after the examination, their findings were never released publicly.
And that is the official seal on the narrative. It prevents public access to the truth, confirming that whatever the inspectors found was deemed too sensitive, too damning, or just too difficult to explain to be made public.
Right. Because if the inspectors found simple, routine maintenance issues, standard safety violations, those findings would have been released. It would have justified the closure and reassured the public.
Of course.
The only logical reason to seal the findings of a heavy machinery examination is if the machines themselves contained explosive evidence.
This could mean anything. They could have found bodily traces related to the missing children, direct evidence linking them to the night guard's death, or just proof that their construction violated so many fundamental industrial regulations that the corporate and regulatory liability was astronomical.
So this is where the concept of erasure becomes central.
Exactly. When official findings are sealed, the very absence of the record becomes the evidence. The deliberate act of preventing knowledge from entering the public sphere confirms that something significant, complex, and highly sensitive occurred. Something the state apparatus was invested in containing and neutralizing immediately.
And the final steps of this concealment process were highly coordinated. They were designed to leave absolutely no physical trace of the compromised machines or the owner's secrets. This was the physical burial of the incident.
Look at the method of removal first. The equipment was taken away by private contractors, not official police evidence crews, not forensics teams, not public waste disposal services.
Why is that detail so important?
Because using private channels bypasses government record keeping, chain of custody protocols, and any public scrutiny about the disposal of massive, potentially compromised industrial property.
It's a clean sweep.
A clean sweep. Completely off the books. It ensures no external party, no journalist, no lawyer, no concerned family member could ever trace where those machines went or what they might have contained.
And the owner, the single individual who held the entire monopoly on maintenance, access, and all the secrets, the one person who could have testified to the true origins and state of those machines.
He is never questioned.
That one detail. It just reinforces the extraordinary coordinated nature of the incident's burial.
This suggests powerful external protection. If the owner, the source of all the mechanical secrets, had been questioned under oath, the entire safety violation pretext would have instantly collapsed.
He would have been forced to admit everything.
The repurposed factory units, the restricted access protocols, and whatever dark activities or negligence occurred during the hours he monopolized those mechanisms. To successfully bury the incident, the person with the most damning information had to be insulated entirely from scrutiny.
And the result of this highly efficient coordinated effort, the suppression was a complete success. The sources say, to this day, the incident is rarely discussed. Which means the local knowledge was successfully strangled, administrative records were sealed, and the event just forward. It faded into rumor. Just another unsettling ghost story tied to a defunct Utah restaurant.
It's the perfect disappearance of a complex, dangerous narrative. The physical evidence, the animatronics, the heavy metal is gone, disposed of secretly.
The administrative evidence, the inspector's findings, is sealed and inaccessible.
And the human witness, the owner, is protected. All that's left is the unsettling folklore, the unaddressed question of the missing children, and the vague metallic memory of dangerous performers in Utah.
So if we step back and synthesize the complete causal chain for you, the listener, it's startling how perfectly every layer of institutional and mechanical failure combined to create this tragedy and then facilitate its erasure.
It really is.
The tragedy began with that fundamental choice, installing heavy, complex industrial robotics, machines never designed to be around children unsupervised. That was the seed of the catastrophe.
And that seed was actively cultivated by the extreme operational control and intentional opacity of the owner, who enforced silence and sealed all the maintenance records. That black box created the necessary environment for the period where children began going missing around the venue.
Which allowed strong circumstantial evidence to remain officially unprovable.
Exactly.
And then the system started to physically implode from the inside out, evidenced by the mechanical anomalies that terrified the staff.
The power spikes confirming heavy unauthorized movement.
The security failures creating active blind spots.
And the physical proof of repositioned dangerous machinery.
And that internal chaos culminated with the sudden suspicious death of the night guard, which was conveniently dismissed as a heart failure.
And the institutional response was pure, highly efficient damage control. The swift closure using the convenient, non-incriminating pretext of safety violations.
Followed immediately by the sealing of the inspector's crucial findings, which confirms the sensitivity of the evidence, and the off-the-books removal of the compromised physical mechanisms by private contractors.
All while protecting the critical human source of the secrets.
It is a profound demonstration of how quickly and thoroughly a sophisticated cover-up can be executed when the true nature of the tragedy involves industrial liability, regulatory failure, and multiple missing persons.
The narrative was strangled at birth.
And successfully relegated to the quiet, unofficial realm of urban legend.
And this is precisely why cultural artifacts and, you know, folklore emerge to fill these informational voids. When the facts are suppressed, the public consciousness demands an explanation, even if it has to create a fictional, sanitized narrative to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that this specific story survived, albeit in a form focused on jump scares rather than hydraulic failures, hints at the true weight and profound disturbance of the real-world events that inspectors and private contractors worked so hard to bury in Utah.
This story of Utah in the late 1980s leaves us with the unsettling realization that the jump scares and jump ropes of the game, you know, are merely a sanitized retelling of something much heavier that the inspectors worked hard to bury.